Hello and welcome to CIFAR Sounding. I'm your host, Simba Wiltz.
And I'm Asla Gonser.
CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of the big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
You can find out more about us on our website at cflar.org.
We're also on social media. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cflar and on Twitter at cflarbigcats.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/CFL Animal Reserve.
Throughout human history, there have been many complicated relationships, and none perhaps are quite as complicated as that between humans and the animals that are around us. There's been much progression in the discussion of humans and animals, but in recent years, it's become even more interesting as some individuals have gone so far as to try to get animals personhood.
Yes, as there are already many laws on the books to prevent abuse of animals by humans. There's lots of abuse laws, but there's no law that gives animals rights as persons.
And this is a very different distinction than the same thing as animal rights. It'd be a lot easier to kind of describe the context in which this conversation actually got started.
Yes, there's actually a lawyer named Stephen Wise, who is the head of the Non-Human Rights Project, and he has filed suits in New York recently in January. He filed an appeal, actually, to give personhood rights to a set of chimps. But going back in the story, the reason why he began this effort is because he had originally filed for rights for a particular dolphin that was in the New England aquarium that was going to be reassigned to the Navy for testing. And there were animal rights groups that were against that dolphin being moved from the aquarium to the Navy for their testing and for their use. And they actually filed suit in court, but the judge threw it out because the dolphin did not have standing. What that essentially means is the dolphin could not speak for himself and say what kind of injury had been done to him or what kind of injury it would pose to be moved to the Navy, and therefore they could not come up with any way to adequately mediate against that. So essentially, Stephen Wise took that to say that because this dolphin did not have personhood rights, they did not have standing to bring this suit against the aquarium moving them.
Now, notwithstanding the sensationalist sound of the idea of giving animals personhood, it's a topic that we have to examine from a logical standpoint as well as from an emotional standpoint, because it's really a very complicated question. One of the first things that people learn, and even animals to a large degree, is a sense of self versus a sense of the outside world. And this concept of self, this concept of personhood, is central to a lot of the arguments that are made for and against having this new status.
And if you look at the information that Stephen Wise is presenting, he's saying that because there are studies done, and he's gotten primatologists to produce many different studies and information backing up their claims, he is saying that chimps do have self-awareness. They do have the sense of past and future. They do have the ability to see or feel the abuse that's done to them and actually want something different than that. So because of that, they require this ability to have personhood in order to protect their autonomy as self.
Which by itself, I don't know, it sounds a little bit far-fetched, don't you think?
That's the question, I suppose. I guess we could start a couple of the studies that were just mentioned offhand that I've seen. Obviously, chimps are higher order beings. We all can agree to that. We know that they're intelligent. We know that they have some level of self-awareness. there's been studies to show some of those kind of things. For example, one of the studies, there was a study where they had chimps in different cages where in order for the other chimp to be fed, the chimp in cage A had to pull a rope for the chimp in cage B to get food. And vice versa, the chimp in cage B would have to pull a rope for the chimp in cage A to get food. And part of the testing was that the chimp in cage A was full, had plenty of food, and wasn't hungry anymore. But still, out of empathy, the chimp would pull the rope so that the other chimp would get food. So that was one of the studies that cited that they do have awareness of empathy for one another.
Well, I would question the validity of that study. I think that we would really need to have a chance to see those studies.
That's true, too.
Not only the way that they're done, but also the way that they're really presented. Because altruistic acts, or the appearance of altruistic acts, happen all the time in nature. Ask any mother bear who protects their cub, or any mother lioness who is willing to leap down a chasm to pull a cub off from a danger. These kinds of acts are not new to the species, but yet somehow, because our understanding of them is different, we are attempting to try and change the way that we as a species have traditionally dealt with and understand them.
But the argument on their side is that those kinds of acts, as you stated, are very common in nature, that they show that animals do have empathy for their own kind.
Yes, this concept of empathy, this concept of even animals having emotion is not news to anyone who has ever worked around animals. But because now science is creating studies and creating mechanisms to try to establish the validity and the frequency of these acts, is it being elevated to the standards of being non-human animals?
Well, that's an interesting point, because obviously we're all animals, even the humans, which is why they specifically call this the non-human rights rather than animal rights. But they're trying to use those kinds of studies to show that there's enough higher order thought in these animals to give them more than status of thing. That's their point with the personhood status, is that right now animals have possession status, the same as a car or, you know, as your house, but not status as a person with actual feelings and thoughts and self-awareness. That brings up a lot of other issues, but that's where they're going with the concept of saying the empathy. One of the other studies, for example, was, well, not so much a study, but an observation. There are many apes and chimps and such that when they're unhappy with their particular situation or enclosure, that they've been known to throw things at people that come to the zoo to watch them.
And if they're lucky, it's just throwing something from their enclosure.
Right. I've actually experienced that firsthand. There were observations that showed there are one particular set of animals, they would go around their cage collecting things like rocks and twigs and sticks and things and storing them in a particular location so that when later the people viewing them were walking by, they could go to that stash of stuff, pick it up, and throw it at the people. So this behavior they were using in this argument to show that the primates do have a sense of past and future, that they're preparing for the future by gathering up these stones and twigs and putting them in a pile, and knowing that later, when the observers come by, that they can have something to throw at them.
It's an interesting theory.
It is, yes.
And I would not put it past the level of intelligence to say that they could conceivably be planning for something. But the reality is that they're still planning for something that is very much within their realm of natural history, which is very much in their realm of what they have naturally been able to do. So, for example, you could have a praying mantis that knows that if it stands in a specific position on a twig, that it will be able to capture other insects because other insects will come by. Or alternatively, if we take it back to big cats in the wild, for example, they may observe that the highest density of prey animals will surround a waterhole. So it makes sense for them to plan their hunts around the times when the waterhole is going to be more in use.
Yes, and obviously he is using those kinds of examples, he being Stephen Wise, putting these together for the case, is using these examples to show the higher order of thought capable by these animals. But as you're stating, that's true of all the animals. They all have some level of higher order thought and capability. You even mentioned a praying mantis. We don't normally associate self-awareness with a praying mantis.
But yet the whole concept of self-awareness, it's so challenging because we know that all of these creatures, even jellyfish, have a nervous system, which means that there are signals that are being sent back and forth. And if it's really just this nervous system reacting to the outside world, and then the animal exhibiting behaviors that shows learning from the reaction of that nervous system, that in and of itself is not self-awareness. So we run into a bit of a slippery slope challenge, because the nervous system of a praying mantis is far less complex than that of a cat or dog or any kind of simian species. We have the trouble of trying to figure out where do we exactly draw the line and how much awareness is self-awareness.
That's a good point, and I don't know if there are any particular studies that can give you that overall sense of self-awareness.
Interestingly enough, some of these arguments are being made on behalf of animals by people, and in many ways, that's somewhat disingenuous. So bear with me for a moment. If you conceptualize a world where this concept of animal equality is fully realized, then at the end of that journey, humans should be able to behave in a manner which is consistent with our gifts and abilities in relation to the natural world without infringement. And animals of all various species should also be able to engage their world with all of their gifts without infringement. Now, if that is a concept for what it looks like at the very end, we already have a very obvious problem. Different animals are being given different gifts that are naturally designed to infringe upon other animals. A great example
good point, yes.
is if we have ungulates, equines, big, strong, but ultimately they're herbivores. But then you have other creatures that are not just carnivores, but obligate carnivores that exist only by eating other creatures. You've got all, of course, the big cats. A lot of them are consummate predators, and they cannot survive off of vegetable matter. Uninfringed, a big cat would be existing in an environment whereby they can obtain, i.e. kill, any of these other animals so that they can sate their natural abilities. Likewise, the prey animals would need to be able to exist in an environment that provides them plenty of grazing, but fundamentally, they would have to take upon themselves the caution on not to be eaten.
Well, and that's how it is in the wild, taking upon the caution of not to be eaten. But the question is if you have personhood status for all those animals, is now the tiger considered a murderer because it killed the deer for food?
Well, that's where I that's where I think that this is really a human game.
Yes.
If we're talking about the natural order, each species organizes itself amongst any number of complex societies. Just as we've talked about big cats, lions, and tigers having complex societies that they've created amongst each other, of course, elephants have complex societies, dolphins have complex societies, simians have complex societies, and even going smaller, ants have complex societies. For us to be trying to incorporate them as persons into a human society would be almost like a bunch of lions trying to decide whether or not they want to invite a human on a hunt.
Thanks for listening to CIFAR Sounding. We'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, my name is Phyllis Park. I am the events coordinator for Central Florida Animal Reserve. Here are some of the events that we have coming up. The next event that's coming up will be our Member Appreciation Day on May 18th, which is a Sunday from 12 until 5 p.m. This is an opportunity to meet the CIFAR staff, see the cats in their home, to ask all of your questions and see what's going on with our future as well as with the cats. We hope to see you at this upcoming event. Come out and see us. Thank you for supporting CIFAR.
Thanks, Phyllis. Enjoy this musical interlude. CIFAR Sounding will be right back. right back. You're listening to CFAR Sounding with host Simba Wiltz and Asla Konser.
You know what this actually reminds me of is the movie Finding Nemo. And there's a scene in there with a group of sharks that are trying to have a, like Sharks Anonymous, they will not eat other fish, which is kind of a silly thought. Obviously, sharks have to eat other fish to survive. But in the movie, of course, they're having this, meeting, kind of like Alcoholics Anonymous. But in their case, it's Sharks Anonymous. And they talk about how they haven't killed anything in how many days. It's just not natural to be able to do that. They would die at some point if they continued that, obviously.
And what's funny about that kind of scenario is that that humor works well for both sides, because there is a fundamental belief amongst some people who call themselves animal advocates that every animal should be able to get along in this kumbaya utopia where no one has to die, everyone gets to live together and sing musicals all day long.
Which works in Disney films.
Which does, perhaps. but even there's somewhat subverted, because the other side of the humor is that everybody, of course, knows that those sharks are not going to be having true Predators Anonymous meetings or whatever it happens to be. They know that that is such a ridiculous scenario that that's what makes it funny.
Absolutely.
And the humor in playing against type is very effective, but it is only couched in the fact that it is playing against type. At the point when people start saying, well, that's how sharks should be, that's when a leap of logic has taken that is kind of a little bit off of the wild end.
Well, that sharks should be having Predators Anonymous meetings?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And because maybe if they just try hard enough, and yes, I have heard this argument before, if we just try hard enough, maybe we can create vegetarian tigers or vegetarian big cats. And wouldn't that be such a victory?
Well.
Because that would show that, you know, the world doesn't have to exist off of this killing motif.
And of course, again, going back to the concept of the types, if you give personhood status to all animals, then those of us that eat a burger or a chicken sandwich, how does that work? We become murderers in that respect as well. That's a whole nother argument as to where does that end. When Stephen Wise was asked that question, he was looking at what he considered higher order animals, and he actually had specifically been looking at chimps, but he's looking at in the future bonobos, orangutans, gorillas, dolphins, orcas, belugas, elephants, and gray African parrots.
The African gray is considered one of the most intelligent parrots. They were some of the first creatures that people started to question their own definition of personhood, because they had this tremendous vocabulary, this tremendous ability to communicate and also understand and mimic our language.
But is their speech mimicking, or are they speaking with purpose?
Well, isn't that the million-dollar question?
Yes.
Just because you make the sounds doesn't mean that you understand them. That could be asked of any species, including our own. If you get somebody who stands up and, for example, says a pledge or says a very specific prayer, are they going through the motions, or is it actually what they're meaning? The threshold for meaning has to be more than whether or not you can say the words.
Absolutely.
It's something that's a little bit more intangible. But we do have certain animals that are incorporated into human society, and because of what they do in society, they have a different set of rules that are applied to them. For example, military dogs, police dogs, and even service dogs.
Yes, and obviously that's near and dear to my heart, because I, as many of you know, am blind, and I do have a service animal. I have a guide dog.
And our guide dog, Jane, is a long-standing part not only of your family, but of your life and your lifestyle. And yet, she would not be considered a person, so to speak.
Right, but she does have more privileges, per se, than other animals. For example, I am able to take her with me to restaurants and to any public place where I can go. She is allowed to go. But that isn't really a right given to her. It's more of a right given to me to take her with me as my guide.
Because the expectation is that the human is the one who is going to be able to participate in human society, so therefore the rights and the responsibilities rest with the member of our species, the humans, even though there are certainly responsibilities, very significant responsibilities, that rest with Jane. And it's the presence of these responsibilities that dictate that she has
more privileges, right,
almost to the level of being able to say that she has the right to be in various places with you. There is a caveat there. She has the right to be in various places with you because she has a responsibility to your safety.
That's correct. And to some degree, I think that's part of the argument that hasn't really been discussed, is giving rights to something or someone also implies responsibility.
You can't get away from the idea that someone can be given rights without responsibility. This has been a troubling trend that people have started to expect rights simply because they exist. And of course, let's keep in mind that the whole concept of rights is a very human concept. This fundamental idea that because we are bipedal, breathing human beings, that just that fact alone conveys a certain set of rights is fundamental to how we interact with our species. We talk about just basic human respect, and basic human respect is not so basic. If you look at the animal kingdom and you look at how species treat other members of their species that they may not be familiar with.
Well, and even in reactions to people meeting other people, what you just mentioned, respect, is a good point. You may start off with a basic level of respect, but really respect is earned between people over time. I would say the same is true of our relationships with our animals. You at the facility certainly have that point of having time to earn or gain the respect of the big cats and for them to also react to you in such a way that you trust them. So it isn't just instantly because you are a living, breathing thing, you instantly have trust, respect, and all those things in hand.
That's a great point. And nowhere is there as much of an obvious experience of having to learn how to trust than when you have to do it with a member that is outside your species. We do occasionally get complacent as humans between each other in thinking that one person owes another person something. And these concepts are so fragile and they're so ephemeral in some cases that it actually causes more disagreements between people because we may think that we're owed something from somebody and they don't. And that disagreement is what oftentimes causes conflict in our society.
That's true. If you get back to the concept that we were just talking about with service animals having some level of privilege, if you were to turn around and say, now not only does Jane have privilege, but she has personhood rights, well, now you also have the responsibility of saying, well, you have to ask the dog, do you want to be a service animal or something? I'm not sure how that really applies in that regard, but it may be that you essentially have given the dog now standing to sue you if you're a bad owner, I guess. Or you wouldn't be an owner at that point, would you?
Well, that's also the other component.
Right.
You know, if a dog could fill out the paperwork, they could file suit.
Right.
Again, paperwork is a human game.
Yes.
And, you know, we're almost coming up on time here, but I think that it's value added to make it clear that we do need to have a very serious discussion in this country and amongst ourselves on what we really are considering for the animals that live amongst us. What is the endpoint? Are we really designed to live kind of this separate existence that is touched on only when we're in close proximity? Or is there some kind of overarching cosmic theme that links us and our animal companions together? And if so, then we need to be thinking tremendously about how far that really goes and how far we want to take that, because obviously people would say, oh, well, we're all interconnected, until they have to sit next to that spider and give it as much respect and rights as they would have to take themselves.
Now realize again that the Non-Human Rights Project was not going to that level. They were leaving it to specific higher order animals that I had listed earlier. And some of the reasons why they picked that set of animals is because there are sanctuaries available so that if cases are won for them, there are places to put these animals. And I understand some of the conditions in which why they have actually done the lawsuits for these particular, their animals are in bad conditions. They're in bad locations. But there's got to be better ways to serve them, to get them into better areas, into sanctuaries, other than just trying to give them personhood rights.
Yes, we have a very robust system for animals, especially higher order animals in this country. Now, when I say robust, meaning that the systems exist, and they're not light systems. For example, in the state of Florida, we have the Fish and Wildlife Commission, which is responsible for all of the animals in the state of Florida, and they are among the most powerful law enforcement officials that exist in the state. They are primarily dealing with those cases of animal welfare. And on top of that, we have USDA and APHIS, which is the department that deals primarily with classed animals in the country. Between the two, we have both federal and state oversight, at least in the state of Florida, and at minimum, federal oversight that can get involved throughout the country. Now, in reality, the USDA component is optional in many cases. There are some states that don't require people to have USDA licensure, and there are some states that don't have any rules whatsoever with regards to that. So that means that there is some variability that comes into play.
There are many organizations currently that are enforcing these laws to stop abusive practices against animals.
Yes, and society has matured to the point where abusing animals is not acceptable.
Absolutely.
When you hear stories of people who find out about these abuses, the reaction is tremendous. It is a tremendous visceral reaction. And it stems, I think, from the idea that someone took advantage of another creature that was in a disadvantaged position to their own betterment. And that seems to bring out the strongest reaction in people.
But that's actually a good evolution that we've had, is that we do have the empathy for the animals. So we're not against animal rights in the sense that we do need to be conscious of how we treat them and we don't want to abuse them. But does that mean we need to go to the step of giving them personhood rights? That's a huge step.
It is. And I would argue that the entire concept of animal rights is a fallacy. What we are really looking for is animal welfare, because it would be impossible for us to expect that any single of these animals is going to be able to be a full member of human society any more than we can expect a human to become a full member of their society.
That's crossing those lines again of types, as you mentioned before.
Right.
And in this case, even species, which is, of course, even a further distinction.
Right, because the true natural behavior, the natural history of both are different. This is not the same as cross-cultural issues. And I know that in the past I've talked about engaging big cats in the same way that you might engage a different culture, but we are talking about engaging another species and becoming a full member of that species is not going to be possible. And we need to recognize that an interface between the species is important.
CFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
Send us your thoughts. You can get us on email via contact@cflar.org.
Tune in again next week for more discussion. My name is Asla Gonser.
And I'm Simba Wiltz. Thanks for listening to CFAR Sounding.